copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
I come originally from New Zealand. I trained in general surgery. My wife and I worked as missionary doctors, and we came to the UK in 1989. And since that time, I've been working with Christian Medical Fellowship, which is a group of about 4,000 doctors and 1,000 medical students throughout the UK and Ireland. And we're also affiliated with 80 similar national bodies around the world in other countries. And part of that work involves bioethics and advocacy, and particularly over the last 9 years, I've been very much involved in a group called Care Not Killing. And Care Not Killing is an alliance of about 40 organisations that was set up in the UK to promote good care and to oppose the legalisation of euthanasia and assisted suicide. And we were set up specifically to combat one particular bill in Parliament, which we did successfully, and then we just had to go on doing it because there's been ongoing pressure in it. So that's, in terms of my background, that's where I'm coming from and how I got interested in these issues. I wanted to start just by reading you the testimony of a doctor who was actually involved in a euthanasia trial where he was in the dock, so he was the one being tried. And I want you to listen very carefully to this, then I'll make some comments about it. So he's speaking here now in his defence as to why he got involved. My underlying motive was the desire to help individuals who could not help themselves. Such considerations should not be regarded as inhuman. Nor did I feel in any way it to be unethical or immoral. I am convinced that if Hippocrates were alive today, he would change the wording of his oath, in which a doctor is forbidden to administer poison to an invalid, even on demand. I have a perfectly clear conscience about the part I played in the affair. I'm perfectly conscious that when I said yes to euthanasia, I did so with the greatest conviction, just as it is my conviction today that it is right. I wonder what you think of that. I, when I'm talking on this issue in secondary schools in Britain, I will often start by reading this out and then I'll ask them a question. I won't ask you the same question. But I'll say, put your hand up if you feel that this is the compassionate response of a compassionate doctor to this issue. And inevitably, I will get a forest of hands. I'd say between 90 and 95% of British secondary school students will be with this person. And I usually don't tell them who the person is until the end of the lecture. But I'll tell you. The words were actually spoken in 1946 by Karl Brandt. And Karl Brandt was the German physician who was responsible under Hitler for orchestrating the Holocaust. Now, the trial at which these words were spoken was the Nuremberg trials. And he was on trial with 23 other doctors for his participation in events before the war in hospitals, but also for his involvement in Auschwitz and other concentration camps. And Brandt was hanged shortly after uttering these words, so you can see that the judges were not impressed by his defence. And what I'm about to start with telling you is history that most people aren't aware of, and even if you would have been to Auschwitz earlier this week and seen what happened there, hands up who has been this week or... Yeah, okay. Then you won't have picked this up from the tour either, because it's not generally spoken of. But let me just give you another quote of a doctor, this time an American doctor, Leo Alexander, who was a psychiatrist who gave testimony at the trial in Nuremberg. And he gave his analysis in 1949 in an article which is well worth reading called Medical Science Under Dictatorship. It was published in the New England Journal of Medicine. And what Alexander said was this: the beginnings at first were merely a subtle shift in emphasis in the basic attitude of the physicians. It started with the attitude basic in the euthanasia movement that there is such a thing as a life not worth living. This attitude in its early stages concerned itself merely with the severely and chronically sick. Gradually, however, the sphere of those to be included in this category was enlarged to encompass the socially unproductive, the ideologically unwanted, the racially unwanted, and then finally all non-Germans. So the whole point here is that what ended in the concentration camps of places like Auschwitz, Dachau, and Treblinka in the 1940s had far more subtle and gentle beginnings in the early euthanasia programs of the late 30s, early 40s, and more importantly, in the ideological framework that was laid over a decade before that. So the point is that what gets whispered in philosophical ivory towers and universities in one generation gets shouted in the streets in the next and gets written into public policy. So let's just trace back that history that's very seldom talked about. First of all, and people will argue that this came out of, we haven't got time to look into the details, but it came out of a kind of politicization of Darwinism, if you like, the survival of the fittest, or turn it around, the non-survival of the weakest. And when such an ideology becomes politicized, it means that the non-survival of the weakest then eventually becomes initially a choice and then eventually a public duty with the appropriate technology and systems to facilitate it. But it built on the views of philosophers like Hegel would be one example in the 19th century, but it had its real beginning or real firm direction setting with a book that was published in the 1920s by a philosopher and jurist in Germany called Karl Binding and Alfred Hock. Now I'm giving the English transliteration, I'm sure my German's not good. But the book had a rather peculiar title. It was called The Release of the Destruction of Human Life Devoid of Value. And what it argued was two things. Firstly, that there was such a thing as a life unworthy to be lived. And the German word that was coined, again, I'm sure my pronunciation is poor, was ballast existenzen, literally human ballast, life unworthy of life. So that was the first principle, that such a thing as that exists. The second principle was that people who act to destroy such a life should be free from prosecution. So it was the release, the legal release from prosecution of the destruction of human life devoid of value. So that was where the ideology came. And during the 1930s, there were a number of developments, but particularly a very effective propaganda program. Now, remember that Germany had emerged from the First World War, poverty-stricken, with considerable societal breakdown, needing to rebuild. And there was a strand of thinking that blamed this upon those people in society who were draining the resources. That included the disabled, the insane, those in institutions. And During the 1930s, the propaganda program even reached into the schools and medical schools. So people in the medical schools, the lecturers would go around showing films, and we still have these films of people in insane asylums, particularly those who were the very worst, sitting in corners, not communicating, dribbling, lighted often from below with torches shining under the chin so that the whole face was in shadow. And the commentary that went along with it was that these people's lives are miserable, and it is a mercy to release them. So this is what medical students were subjected to. But even with school children, mathematics problems saying how much money could be freed for the building of new homes if we didn't have to spend this amount on caring for the incurable, insane, and so on. So, and then they give the figure for each so that the students could work it out. And then the next step was a propaganda film that was produced in 1941. So remember, the war's just started at this point. And the English title of it was I Accuse, but it was it involved a woman with multiple sclerosis, with a degenerative neurological condition, who wanted to die. Her husband was a doctor, and she begged him to help her. And so in the film, he gives a lethal injection to his wife whilst another colleague plays soft piano music in a nearby room. And then he confesses the crime, he goes to court, and most of the film concentrates on the trial where he gives his defence. And it ends with him, the title I Accuse comes not from the people who are prosecuting this doctor, but actually it's his accusation towards everybody watching that he accuses them of lacking compassion for not supporting him in the decision he made. Now, again, if you showed a film like that, there's been some very similar films just being produced by the French called L'Amour, which came out a couple of years ago, with an almost identical storyline. And if you show a film like this, it changes public opinion. Now, what many people don't know is that the film was actually commissioned by Goebbels. And it was commissioned by Goebbels on the suggestion of none other than Karl Brandt, who we just talked about. So it was part of a program. Now, the euthanasia program began in 1939, when Brandt gave a lethal injection to a baby who had was blind and deaf, and also had limb abnormalities, the congenital abnormalities. And this was carried out under the auspices and with the full sanction of the Führer, and with the parents' consent as well. And that led to the setting up of a unit at an address known as Tiergartenstrasse 4, 4 Tiergarten Street in Berlin. And what happened there was that a group of psychiatrists and paediatricians would look at the medical charts of children with disabilities that were brought to them, and on the basis not of any clinical assessment but simply looking at the notes, they would make a decision whether to put a plus or a minus in the box. And so this is how the children's euthanasia program started in the late 1930s, and it led to 6,000 deaths of children. What followed then was the adult euthanasia program. And what drove this was that there was a need for accommodation for three reasons. First of all, there were German nationals coming back to Germany from abroad now that the war had started and requiring housing. Secondly, there were soldiers who'd been injured in the war who needed housing and hospitalisation. And thirdly, on top of that, there were people who'd lost their homes in the bombing. And they calculated that they needed 60,000 beds quickly. And so again, this was very clinically calculated, that they could release 6,000 ready-made beds by removing 60,000 patients from six major hospitals, of which the most famous was Hadamar. And these were adult hospitals looking after elderly people and people who had psychiatric conditions, who were mentally ill. They wrote to the relatives asking them to, in some cases, ask them to take their relatives home. When there was no response, they could see the coast was clear, and they started killing these people with lethal injections. They then realized it wasn't quick enough for their purposes, and they experimented with other means of killing, and that's how Cyclone B, the drug that was actually, the gas that was used in the Holocaust, was developed, because it could be done more quickly. But all the initial experiments were done using medical staff, doctors, nurses, and orderlies. That program came into its own in the early 1940s, and then the medical staff who'd been involved in it were then redeployed to camps like Auschwitz. So a desensitization program had already happened with these people. So when you arrived at Auschwitz and you came off the train and you walked up the ramp, and at the top there was a person who either, you know, went left or right to the work camp, or the 20% to the work camps, 80% to the furnaces. That person, at least in the initial stages, was a doctor, although wearing a Nazi uniform. And it was actually Joseph Mengele who was involved in that selection process. So there's the background. Now, chilling stuff, and it's all been very carefully documented, but we didn't hear anything about it on the tour the other day. You need four ingredients for this to happen. The first one is you need to have public opinion in favour, or at least not opposed. And the German population either didn't know, had chosen to ignore it, or they were convinced that actually this was a compassionate thing to do, at least in the early stages. The second ingredient is that you need a handful of willing doctors to be involved. And that they say that they said at Nuremberg that without the willing cooperation of sections of the German medical profession, the whole thing probably would never have happened. But by 1933, 6% of the members of the German medical profession were already members of the Nazi Party as well. So you don't need the whole profession, just a handful of willing doctors. The third thing is economic pressure. And we had that, of course, in the Depression after the First World War, which affected many countries around the world. But there's nothing quite like the economic pressure that war itself generates. And then the final ingredient is a law that allows it. Now, interestingly, in Germany, there was never a law passed to authorize euthanasia. It was just that people were not prosecuted. And this is probably the reason why those doctors who conscientiously objected didn't suffer any consequences. They were just allowed not to do it. And the flip side, of course, is that those who were involved were willingly involved. They were not coerced to be involved in the same way that perhaps the SS were. We learnt on Saturday that there were 24,000 SS soldiers who refused to be involved at Auschwitz, and all of them ended up on the Russian front as a result. So there was coercion for them, but not for the doctors in the same way. So after the Second World War, really as a result of the involvement of the medical profession, the World Medical Association felt it was necessary to restate their historic oaths. And the Hippocratic Oath, which was drafted in 600 BC, contained the clause, "I will give no deadly medicine to anyone, nor suggest such counsel." And so it has for 2,000 years, not just in Judeo-Christian tradition, but as part of general medical Hippocratic tradition, that a doctor must never actively take the life of a patient. And so this needed to be restated. And they adopted a number of post-war declarations, of which the most famous was the Declaration of Geneva. And that says, I will maintain the utmost respect for human life from the time of conception, interestingly, until death. That was passed in 1948 and embraced by all the medical associations around the world. And then the International Code of Medical Ethics says, I will always bear in mind the obligation of preserving human life from the time of conception until death. And then later, interestingly, as recently as 1992, the Statement of Marbella was adopted by the World Medical Association, which says that assisted suicide, like euthanasia, is unethical and must be condemned by the medical profession. So whereas the views on abortion have changed quite dramatically, as a general rule all around the world, in most countries, the majority of doctors remain opposed to any change in the law to allow euthanasia. So there's our background. Now, when we talk about this issue, we need to first get our definitions right. And euthanasia is the intentional killing of a person whose life is felt no longer to be worth living. And the intentional killing of a person whose life is felt no longer to be worth living. And generally, it's done on compassionate grounds. It can be voluntary, where the person asks for it. It can be involuntary, where the person hasn't asked, but it happens anyway. Or it can be non-voluntary, where the person is incapable of asking for it simply because they lack mental capacity. Maybe they have dementia or head injury or whatever. And then assisted suicide is where the doctor helps the patient to end their own life. So the final act is carried out by the patient, either by injecting, pushing a button, or whatever. Now, it's important. We would argue that the two acts are morally equivalent, because they both involve the intentional ending of a person's life. But in terms of law, they're often treated differently because of who does the final step on it. Now, there are several misconceptions about it, and it's worth just saying a word about each of these. The first is that withdrawal of treatment is not euthanasia. Withdrawal of treatments can sometimes be unethical. For example, in the case of a young person who has pneumonia, which is easily treatable, but they'll die without treatment. If you neglect to treat them, then that's profoundly unethical. It's called negligence. But it's different in quality from euthanasia, because they're dying from the disease rather than from something that you are doing actively to end their life. And withdrawal or withholding treatment can actually be good medicine in the circumstance where death is imminent, inevitable, you're powerless to stop it, and when the treatment itself is worse than the disease. So there are occasions, perhaps in very advanced cancer, where you might decide that further chemotherapy is not going to offer a cure, and the side effects in terms of nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, or whatever, will make the last days of that patient's life so unpleasant that it's better to withhold that treatment. So active killing are always wrong and unethical. Allowing someone to die may be wrong, but it may also equally be good medicine in certain circumstances, simply recognising medicine's limits. And Martin Lloyd-Jones, who was a famous British preacher and a doctor, when he died, allegedly said in the closing days, "Please don't hold me back from the glory." So he was saying, no more treatment. Treatment at this stage will be worse than the disease. And I think it underlines the fact that we can make two mistakes in medicine. We can under-treat people inappropriately, but we can also over-treat them, giving treatments of diminishing value when all hope is gone and where the side effects are unacceptable. Secondly, morphine and double effect. If you're giving strong pain relief to relieve pain. And as a secondary result, but not your intention, the patient's life is shortened because of that. That's not euthanasia. The key ethical difference is that your intention was not to kill the patient, but to relieve the pain. Now, having said that, this is something that is probably more talked about by philosophers than doctors, because a doctor who works in palliative medicine, which is medicine at the end of life, will tell you that in good hands, the therapeutic dose, which relieves the pain substantially, is always lower than the lethal dose, which kills the patient. So in other words, if someone's claiming they have to give a huge dose of morphine to relieve the symptoms, then they are either being deceitful or they're incompetent. They don't know what they're doing. Okay. Thirdly, refusal of treatment. If a mentally competent patient, someone who's able to make decisions, refuses a treatment, a life-saving treatment, and they die as a result from the disease, that's not euthanasia. It's refusal of treatment. And the reason for going through those in some detail is because there's a huge amount of misunderstanding about these basic things within the general population and in the churches. So next, third section, where are we at in Europe and around the world today? And we could spend a lot more time on this, but I'll just give you a summary. There are four countries in Europe where the law has changed to allow assisted suicide or euthanasia or both. In the Netherlands, euthanasia has been legally sanctioned for about 25 years. In other words, it's been very difficult for any doctor to be prosecuted provided they follow a set of guidelines. And so euthanasia numbers started to escalate in the Netherlands in the 1990s, but it wasn't formally and properly legalized until 2001. However, since the mid-2000s, around 2005-06, there's been a steady escalation in the total number of cases, a 15 to 20% increase per year, and we're up around 5,000 cases per year at the moment, of which around 500 to 1,000 are involuntary. In other words, the patient hasn't requested it, even though that's against the law to do it in those circumstances. There's been extension to patients with mental illnesses and dementia. There are mobile euthanasia units which will deliver, which will go to patients' homes and carry out euthanasia, and under what's called the Groningen Protocol, named after a Dutch city where it was arisen, handicapped children can have euthanasia as well, despite the fact that that's against the Dutch law. It goes on and there aren't prosecutions. In the Netherlands, both euthanasia and assisted suicide are legal. In Belgium, only euthanasia is legal, not assisted suicide. But again, it was legalized in 2001. And Belgium is really now the euthanasia capital of Europe, where things are moving much more quickly even than in the Netherlands. We've had a 500% increase in the number of cases per year since it first came in, from the first full year. And about a third of cases are involuntary, where the patients aren't asked, and there have been a lot of very high-profile cases around the world. A set of twins who were deaf and going blind, a woman with a mental illness, depression, who was killed, and just earlier this year, Belgium have legalized euthanasia for children with terminal illnesses as well. But we know that with adults, it's not just those with terminal illnesses who are being killed. In Luxembourg, both euthanasia and assisted suicide are legal, but the population is small, the numbers are small, and difficult to obtain. And in Switzerland, assisted suicide has been legal for many, many years, but not euthanasia. And Switzerland is perhaps unique in that foreign nationals can go there, and this is why there's been so much publicity around the Dignitas clinic that's carrying out most of these cases. Again, there's been a 400% increase in the number of cases. So the general pattern we're seeing across Europe in these four countries is a steady increase in the numbers per year, and an expansion of the categories from adults to children, from terminal illnesses to chronic illnesses, and from voluntary euthanasia to involuntary euthanasia, coupled with virtually no prosecutions at all. And in fact, in Belgium, the reason for that is very simple. It's that the person who chairs the committee which is overseeing the governance of the law is actually the leading euthanasia doctor in the country, Dr. Distelmans. So we have a situation where he's been appointed to oversee his own activity. Well, we know in governance terms that doesn't really work. In other countries, there's pressure and bills. In the UK at the moment, we've got two bills before Parliament, one before the upper house, House of Lords, and one before the Scottish Parliament, both of which will be debated this year. And we have a very high-profile court case involving a man with locked-in syndrome and two others who joined him, and we're waiting for the Supreme Court judgment on that, which will come out any time now. So it's probably the UK that's the main focus now of this, but there's talk of a bill in France and in Germany, and there are other high-profile cases elsewhere, and there's no doubt that this pressure is going to increase. We have a group called the Euthanasia Prevention Coalition of Europe that involves people from all of these countries, and we meet regularly to compare notes and to act together and share information. Now, I talk here about economic recession and demographic shift, and there's another feature to this whole thing, and that's that the population structure in most Western countries and in European countries is changing, so that the population pyramids in the year 1950 used to look a bit like Nigeria, like this. So at the bottom of the pyramid, you've got lots of young people and very few old people at the top. Now, the population structures look pretty much like this in most European countries, pretty even all the way up. But in 2050, it's going to be like this. And that's for two reasons, because older people are living longer, there's better medical treatment, but also there are far fewer births taking place. Part of that is due to abortion, but part of it is due to economic factors, people voluntarily choosing to have smaller families. The other thing that's changing is that the percentage of people in the workforce is diminishing, so that now 2/3 of people in Europe are between the ages of 15 and 65, so they're in the working population, if you like. But by the time we get to 2050, the ratio will be 50%, so only 1 out of 2 will be in the working population. That means you've got a smaller number of people working to generate the finance to support those who are dependent either at the beginning or end of life. And you put that together with escalating debt, rising unemployment, economic recession, you've got quite a lethal cocktail. And so some commentators have been led to say that there's a real danger that the generation that killed its children through abortion could well be killed by its children through euthanasia, unless something happens to change that. Now, I'm painting a bleak picture necessarily, because I think the dangers are really huge, which is why it's so important to resist these moves that we're seeing. So going now to biblical principles, yeah. I think what we're seeing is that we're now in a post-Christian society. So we see more and more people are atheist, and more people have secular humanist worldviews. And so they have these four things acting together. The first is autonomy. You know, it's my choice. Then there's what I call personal peace. You know, this is what we want, and an unwillingness to face any degree of suffering, it seems to me. And then thirdly, there's the whole issue of technology. We can do it. And then finally, you put into that mix moral relativism. Why not? And I think that, coupled with a loss of hope about life beyond death and loss of hope in this life, and perhaps people investing their lives in the idols of materialism and personal peace. And the question is, you know, what happens when those things are threatened? And the problem is, a lot of people are living for you know, they've built their lives on foundations which could be taken away. And when we build our life on the foundation of Christ and the hope of eternal life, and we see hope in the future in spite of suffering, we have a different attitude when these things happen. But if your meaning in life comes from the fact that you can, that you're healthy and can be involved in certain activities, or your ability to earn money, or you know, or the fact that you've got people around you who will love and support you, those things can all be stripped away and leave you in a situation. So we had a peculiar situation in Britain recently where we had a young man of 15 years of age who got advanced bowel cancer, and he had treatment, but it was incurable. And this was a young man with an incredible attitude to life. He really loved life, he enjoyed life, he wanted to make the best of every moment he had left of life. And so he went on and did all these things, you know, jumping out of aeroplanes and visiting various places and so on. But then as he got worse, he then decided that he wanted to do something that would make an impact to help others in his situation. And so he started a campaign to raise money for child cancer research and care. And he raised over £3.5 million on a campaign. And, you know, we see pictures of this guy a few days before death with a big smile on his face, you know, life is great, I treasure life. And people watching this said, this man, you know, lived more lifetimes in the 4 years between his diagnosis and death than most people do in a whole lifetime. Now, contrast that on the other hand with a celebrity couple in Britain, Richard and Judy, who, you know, celebrities, I'd say, were members of the liberal elite, humanists, and they were interviewed and said, and he said, if ever I got cancer, I'd want to take a glass of gin and a gun into a room and shoot myself through the head. Now, these are people in their 50s who've got probably 3 decades of life ahead. Now, why is it that we have a man who's critically ill, who's full of zest for life, and another person who's just fearing that possibility in the future, but they're talking? There are some people who, the more euthanasia is that there is, the more happy they are about, you know, control over all the rest. But yes, there are many people who are afraid to go into hospitals and nursing homes because of what might happen. Okay, so what does the Bible say about this whole issue? And this will be a rapid transit through, but there are important biblical principles. There are 2 cases of euthanasia in the Bible, interestingly. So we have Abimelech, one of the judges, who was a bad man storing a tower. A woman threw a millstone off the top and hit him on the head. And as he's dying, he says to his armor bearer, please kill me, so that it cannot be said that a woman killed Abimelech. You might say, you know, he sought death with dignity, if you like. And then the other case involves Saul, who you remember at the end of his life was wounded in battle. And there are 2 accounts of his death, but in one of them he asks an Amalekite soldier to kill him because he's in great pain. So death for compassionate reasons. So we have these 2 cases. Of course, we can't base a case on narrative, but they're interesting. And so what we do is to look at the principles that are there in Scripture. And we see, first of all, this concept of the image of God, that human beings are special, they're unique, they're made in God's image, they're very precious because of that. And it's the image of God that's given as the reason, after the flood narrative in Genesis chapter 5, that human life can't be taken. And it goes something like this. If anyone sheds the blood of a human being, then they pay for it with their life, because human beings are made in the image of God, is effectively what it says. And that became the basis of the sixth commandment, you shall not kill. And if you look at the way the sixth commandment is expounded in the Old Testament and ask, well, what do they mean by kill? You have to look at the context in which it's used. But what it's talking about here is the intentional killing of an innocent human being. So that's to distinguish it from things like manslaughter, which is unintentional killing, from the killing of animals, which doesn't involve killing human beings, and the killing of people who are, if you like, legally guilty in the context of capital punishment or war or in self-defense. But the underlying principle is that the intentional killing of an innocent human being is always wrong, which is why there's so much in the Bible about the shedding of innocent blood. And you might remember that the fall of the southern kingdom of Judah, remember how the 12 tribes split into two nations with the 10 tribes going north with Israel that were wiped off the map by Assyria. And then you had the southern kingdom of Judah, which lasted longer until it was taken into Babylonian captivity. And if you read the books of Kings and Chronicles, the reason that the Lord gives in the scriptures for the eventual destruction of the southern kingdom was the fact that King Manasseh, one of the last kings, shed so much innocent blood that the Lord was not willing to forgive. And even though his son Josiah was a just and upright man who brought about religious revival, nonetheless, as a result of the sins of Manasseh, it wasn't just the shedding of innocent blood, idolatry as well, but it's the shedding of innocent blood that was particularly picked out. And we know we are fallen creatures. Human beings are capable of great evil. If anyone doesn't believe that evil exists, then you just need to take them for a walk around Auschwitz, and we see it in its fullest form there. But of course, all of us see it in our own hearts as well, in lesser developed form. As Christians, of course, we see things in the light of eternity, and death is not the end; it's a gateway to judgment and one of two destinations. And our eternal hope is that we look to a new heaven and a new earth. And then we would argue that we see things through the eyes of faith, which makes at least some sense of suffering or gives us the ability to bear it in a way that wouldn't be possible, in the light of hope that we will be resurrected with Christ and have bodies like his and be reunited with our loved ones, and then in the light of love that we're called to bear one another's burdens and to help one another. And I put here the third way of redemptive love. Now, what I mean by that is that the reference here is to John 8, which is the woman caught in adultery. And you remember that the people brought this woman who was caught in the act of adultery before Christ, and they gave him a choice. Moses' law says this woman should be stoned to death, but, you know, what do you say? And Jesus, you know, either had to pronounce the verdict, you know, or let the woman off. Both of them seemed to be morally wrong things to do because of what the law had said. And of course he said, let he who is out without sin cast the first stone, and they all went off. But he was the only person there who could have carried out the sentence. But he chose not to. He forgave the woman. He called her to repentance. He then went to the cross and paid the price for her sins and all of ours as well. And we don't know whether that woman became a believer, but we do know that Christ's death and resurrection were sufficient to pay the price. So he had the choice of judgment or letting off, or the path of the cross, which is the path he took. And I think when we look at the issue of euthanasia, it seems like a choice. You know, either we let this person die in serious pain, or alternatively, we give them a lethal injection. It seems an impossible choice. But actually, there is a third way here, and I'd say it's the way of the cross, because it involves investing our time and energy and resources in caring for that person in a way that addresses not just their physical pain, but also their emotional and spiritual suffering as well. And that's the costly route that we walk as followers of Christ. And this is why in history it's been Christians who have pioneered the growth of the hospice movement and the development of the specialty of palliative care as well. They've been right at the forefront of doing it. Now, I'll just skip the next section because I could come back to that in discussion. But I just wanted to talk about the arguments, because as well as being aware of the history and thinking this through from a biblical perspective, as Christians, I believe that we have to be prepared to debate it in the public square and to talk to people in the churches and outside the churches about it. And so we need to have a handle on the arguments. And it's not enough simply to argue from the Bible with people who don't accept the authority of the Bible. So we can use Christian arguments, but we put them in secular language to convince people. So this is one of the things that we've found works effectively. And there are three arguments for euthanasia. The first one is compassion, that it demands that it's a compassionate response. Of course, the response to that is to say that true compassion provides proper care for people, looks after them properly, and that if you look after people properly, they don't want euthanasia. And palliative medicine doctors will tell you that they could count on the fingers of one hand those patients who have ongoing persistent requests for euthanasia once they've seen that care is available. Second argument is autonomy. It's my choice. But we would argue against that there are limits to autonomy in a democratic society, that none of us has the right to do whatever we want to do if allowing that would create risk or difficulty for other people. And the point is that if you change the law to allow euthanasia, you at the same time remove legal protection from vulnerable people. And so in the same way that we accept, even though we may think we're the best drivers in the world, we accept there are speed restrictions on motorways because the faster people drive, the more people get killed. And we will accept lining up at an airport and being searched and photographed and having all our equipment and personal possessions looked through, because we know that is the price of knowing that we're all going to be safe on the aeroplane when we get there, particularly in a time of terrorism. So the point is that all laws restrict personal autonomy. And actually, none of us really believe that there are no limits to autonomy. That's why we accept laws, because we believe that there's a trade-off between protecting the vulnerable many and giving liberties to the few. And so that means that, yes, even in the most deserving cases, you say, or you think the cases that sway you most in your heart, you say, no, if we change the law, the price is too great. We've got to invest it in better care. And then the third argument that you hear sometimes is economics. We just simply can't afford to look after these people. Of course, the great danger of that is that it might cost thousands of euros to provide chemotherapy and hundreds of euros to provide good palliative care per week. But it only requires a handful of euros to buy a glass full of barbiturate or a syringe full of that. And of course, when you put that temptation up to healthcare providers or politicians, it's obvious which route they can go to save the most money, isn't it? And it was economic considerations that drove the Holocaust to a large extent. So those are the arguments for. The arguments against: number one, it's dangerous to change the law. It's dangerous because once you change the law to allow euthanasia, you put pressure on vulnerable people to end their lives out of fear of being a burden to others, either a financial or emotional burden. Because once the door is open to allow it, then particularly elderly people are going to think, I'm too much of a burden on others, it's my duty. And so the so-called right to die so easily ends up becoming the duty to die. And there are very subtle forms of coercion that can operate within families. And sometimes it's just an internalized sense of duty that people feel that they should do the decent thing and take it. Secondly, you get the problem of incremental extension. And we've seen that already in the Netherlands and Belgium, that once you allow it for a small category of people, you get pressure to extend those boundaries. So it starts with voluntary, it becomes involuntary. It starts with terminal illness, it goes to chronic illness. It starts with adults, And then people will say, well, what about children aged 12 to 14 who are mentally competent and so on? Exactly what's happened in Belgium. And so you get, you know, extension, incremental extension. It's inevitable once you accept the principle. And the third thing is that safeguards in practice are unworkable, and we've seen those in all the European countries, because not only do doctors go up to the new law, but they go beyond it and they're not prosecuted, and so they then go further. And if we use the parallel of abortion, in Britain, for example, we have quite a restrictive abortion law, which if it was obeyed to the letter, would result in about 2,000 abortions a year. But in fact, there are 200,000 abortions a year, and no doctor ever gets prosecuted. So about 98% of these abortions are illegal. So it's not just what the law says, it's what doctors can do and get away with. And you will always get a handful of people who get a taste for this and who will then push the boundaries. And whatever the law says, you know, that they'll go ahead and say, well, I think this case is deserving. Secondly, it's unnecessary to change the law because what we should be doing is investing in good care. And I think it was you earlier who was saying, you know, here we are in these very rich countries. Of course, they're very indebted countries as well. So to some extent, we're living in, you know, in fantasy because the debt is greater. But the point is, it's a really good question to ask, why is it that there's a push for euthanasia in Europe, where we have excellent medical care, generally? And yet, I worked as a missionary doctor in Kenya, in Africa, with subsistence farmers who had very little medical care, and I never met anyone who wanted euthanasia. They all desperately wanted to live. And I think what I observed is that they valued life in a way that people in the West don't. They had stronger communities and better reason for living. But they also seem to be able to endure suffering in a way that perhaps we're not able to anymore in Europe. You know, we've been too mollycoddled and looked after. And then the third reason is that for change, not changing the law, is that the best law is one which balances justice and mercy. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, I think the very best laws in this area are those which give a blanket prohibition on all medical killing for any reason, whether it is euthanasia or assisted suicide or whatever. A blanket prohibition with strong penalties. But they also give discretion to prosecutors and judges to be able to exercise mercy in the hard cases. And those are the kind of laws that exist in most countries in Europe at the moment. So that if you get a really hard, desperate case that comes up, then the judge, the police will decide whether it's in the public interest to go ahead and prosecute. And if a prosecution takes place, the judge will be lenient in giving sentence because they will exercise compassion. But once you change the principle, then the whole thing gets out of control. That's the argument. Okay, so just very quickly then, how do we respond? Well, there are four key battlegrounds in this area. The first is in Parliament, stopping laws which will erode freedoms. Secondly, within the institutions, and particularly the medical profession, one of the major things stopping the legalisation is medical opposition. And I think the reason that the Netherlands legalised euthanasia, I think one of the main reasons is that the medical profession did not object to it. In fact, they actively backed it. And the most dangerous places in the world with regard to new legislation are places where the medical profession is weak. So probably the most critical place in the whole world presently is the province of Quebec in Canada. And the reason it's so dangerous is because the medical profession is very weak there in their opposition. And in Britain, even though we've had incredible pressure to change the law, the medical profession up until this point has remained strongly opposed. And that's a major reason for Parliament to think twice about changing it. The courts, because it doesn't matter what the law says, the courts have to uphold the law. And if they don't, you will get extension. And then finally, the media and public opinion is a big battlefield, because the battle here is won or lost ultimately in the living rooms of ordinary people. And what happens in the media and arts and entertainment has a profound influence in changing opinions, just as it did in Germany back in the 1930s. So we need to educate Christians to think through this. I'm encouraged that you've come to this seminar and see the importance of it. But many people in the churches have never really addressed this issue deeply, and many preachers don't talk about it. Inspiring stories of hope, I think, make a huge difference, of people who've had good care, who changed their minds. We've had a campaigner in Britain who, a lovely Christian lady with very severe disabilities, who just died last December. She was promoted to glory. But she went through a long period of being suicidal before she was converted, and in her early Christian years as well. And her testimony was always that if the law had changed at that time, she would have made use of it, and she would have then missed the 10 best years of her life, she said, because it was actually learning to come through the suffering. And she ended up investing in and working in a charity which cared for disabled children in India. It became the new meaning and purpose in her life, and she was a wonderful, radiant, joyful Christian who endured great suffering and yet was an inspiration to people. So I think inspiring stories help. Organised opposition, and what we had to do in the UK was establish what we call a co-belligerent alliance, as I've said, and it was realising that in order to fight this, we can't combat it just as a very small Christian group, but we have to involve others as well. And so we set up a coalition which brought together evangelical groups, Catholic groups, other faith groups, even Muslims and Hindus, who were all opposed to this as well, doctors and other professionals, and perhaps even most importantly, disability rights groups. So these were people who weren't necessarily with us on other issues and didn't share our faith, but nonetheless were very concerned about this, and we found that it was much better to fight these issues standing together with them in, you know, what Francis Schaeffer called a co-belligerent fashion. So we've got about, more or less, there's a bit of time for questions. Yeah, so euthanasia, the intentional killing of a human being whose life has felt not to be worth living. Voluntary is where the patient asks for it. Involuntary is where they're capable of asking for it, but you just don't ask them. You just make the decision and end their life. And so that involves some level of deceit as well. You know, we're just giving you a little injection. Non-voluntary is where the patient is incapable of asking for it because they lack the mental competence to do it. Now, maybe a baby or an elderly person with dementia or someone who's unconscious after a head injury, and you just make the decision and say, well, it's what they would have wanted or whatever. And does that make sense?
Yeah.
That was answering the question, could I clarify the difference between voluntary euthanasia, involuntary euthanasia, and non-voluntary euthanasia? Yeah. So the question is about the new law allowing euthanasia for children in Belgium, which has no age limit for it. And so how are they going to know whether they're voluntary, involuntary, or non-voluntary, or whatever? Well, it's going to be very difficult, but on the basis of past precedent in Belgium, there hasn't been a single prosecution for adult euthanasia, despite the fact a lot of it has broken the law. So I expect that all hell's going to break loose with children as well, and that there will be doctors who push the boundaries and nothing will happen, unfortunately. I think it's an absolutely tragic situation. And
I have a comment. I think that one...
No, absolutely. For the tape, you're making the point that one of the key problems we're facing is this commitment to utilitarianism, that a life that doesn't have pleasure or has suffering is actually not worth living, and that we need to address that. I couldn't agree more. It's not just a matter of changing the law. It's got to be the heart of society that changes. And I suspect that that's not really going to happen without a change in the Christian direction of Europe as well. However, there's no question, laws might not change people's hearts, but they do restrain the heartless, and they do make people think twice about breaking the law. And that's why the disability rights lobby in particular will argue that there must be strong penalties to act as a deterrence, otherwise people will take liberties. And what disabled people say is, nothing about us without us. Nothing about us without us. And don't you dare make a value judgment about the worth of my life. If I decide my life is worth living, then you cannot make these decisions for me. And I think a lot of this is being driven by what we'd call the worried well. People who are able-bodied but afraid of losing something. And people who are sick, chronically ill, or terminally ill, or disabled, generally do not want euthanasia. They come to value more and more the life that they still have. And even a life with significant suffering, they still value it for what it is, like the young man I told you about. Well, the question for the tape was, palliative care isn't the answer for everybody because there are some symptoms that can't address. And that, I mean, that is correct. You cannot, if someone's dying of motor neurone disease, then no palliation will reverse the paralysis, for example. But there's no question also that in good hands, in the hands of a well-skilled palliative medicine physician, that symptoms like pain and nausea and so on can be well attended to. And I think part of the problem is that the skills are not widely taught, and sometimes access to the care is not widely available. But if you listen to the pro-euthanasia lobby, it's only very, very rarely that you'll hear them now using physical symptoms as a reason for wanting the law to change. And if we look at jurisdictions who have changed the law, if you take Oregon, the state of Oregon in the US, for example, which has legalized assisted suicide, and look at the reason why people are actually making use of that law, then the top reasons have nothing whatsoever to do with physical symptoms. They are loss of meaning and purpose, loss of enjoyment of life, inability to engage in the activities that I used to, or that the old thing of that I feel I'm a burden to others. So in other words, it's more existential symptoms than physical symptoms, more spiritual symptoms, if you like, which brings us back to the point in saying that our care has to be comprehensive, not just physical, but also addressing social, psychological and spiritual needs as well. And we may not be able to meet everything, but we should put all our effort into trying to do what we can, whilst recognising that there will be some people who are so despairing and without hope that whatever you offer them, they won't be satisfied with it. Time's up, I think, so thank you very much for coming. Hope that was useful and that you can please do use it in your own context as well. Thank you.